Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Stumbling, sputtering, tripping, stalling, lurching. Any word you use to describe the economic recovery, it's just not pretty. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Friday. It is the third day of June. No matter how you bite down on it, that was a pretty sour-tasting jobs report we got from the Labor Department this morning. Here are the headline numbers. 54,000 jobs total added to the economy in May. We were seeing more like 220,000 a month earlier this year. Unemployment ticked up to 9.1%, declines in manufacturing and temp work, and tens of thousands of jobs cut from state and local governments. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has more.
People unemployed 6 months or longer now make up 45% of those actively looking for work, near a record high. Heidi Shierholz analyzes the labor market at the Economic Policy Institute.
What we're facing now is just an enormous, across-the-board lack of demand for workers. In every occupation, in every industry, we've seen this increase of long-term unemployment.
And who are they? It's everyone from teachers, that's government budget cuts, to construction workers and mortgage brokers, the housing crash, to hotel clerks and airline pilots, blame high oil prices. They do tend to have one thing in common, though.
If you are an older worker, if you've spent many years or a career building up a specific set of skills and experience, you're more likely to get stuck in unemployment for long periods.
And when you find something, you jump at it, even if it's a big step down.
There comes a time when, even if it's not the job that you had your heart set on, that you have to face reality and take whatever comes along.
Carol Montana's 58. She used to be an editor. After 4 years of being unemployed, she swallowed a 25% pay cut to take a job as a welfare caseworker in New York State. Her new job's precarious, though. There's a probation period and budget cuts are looming. Labor economist Justin Wolfers at the Brookings Institution says the whole labor market's precarious.
This is the point where the recovery was meant to be bringing people back to work. And we were hoping that the long-term unemployed, people who've been out of work 6, 9, 12 months, would be reintegrated into this important social and economic institution.
At the current pace of economic growth and job creation, we'll likely have millions of long-term unemployed for years to come. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Congratulations, Uncle Sam. You just sold a car company, kind of. President Obama visited a Chrysler factory in Ohio today, fresh off the Treasury Department's deal to sell its remaining 6% stake in the car company to Italy's Fiat. Washington assumed the stake in Chrysler 2 years ago. As part of that bailout, Fiat agreed to take on management and a minority stake. With this sale, Fiat will own 52% of Chrysler. Of course, this isn't Chrysler's first international marriage. It used to be owned by German carmaker Daimler, and that was one rocky relationship. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith looks at whether a partnership with Fiat will be any more nurturing.
Long-distance relationships can be challenging, and in the auto industry, nearly fatal. Daimler bought Chrysler in 1998 and sloughed it off 9 years later, bleeding money and in need of major reorganization. Jeremy Anwyl is the CEO of Edmunds.com.
One of the cultural problems was that the Mercedes folks were always worried about diluting the prestige or damaging the Mercedes brand by using some of the Mercedes technologies too overtly in Chrysler, Dodge, or Jeep vehicles.
But the Fiat marriage could last, says Anwyl. Fiat is using Chrysler's dealers to sell its models, and their products complement each other.
Chrysler has got a lot of product strength in traditional American vehicles, pickup trucks, minivans, Fiat has a lot more strength in the smaller cars, and these are becoming very, very important today in sort of an era of higher gas prices.
The union with Fiat is also making Chrysler more attractive for investment, says Robert Schultz, managing director of corporate ratings at Standard & Poor's.
So, you know, it's very early days, but Chrysler's business profile, we think, is enhanced by having the Fiat ownership.
Edmunds.com's Jeremy Anwell says it's a time of shifting gears in the auto industry. Customers are becoming less interested in horsepower and more interested in electronic perks and fuel efficiency. Anwell says Fiat and Chrysler are well positioned to be nimble in that evolving climate. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
If you want the opposite side of what we talked about up top, an economy dragging its feet, well, look to China, where economic growth has spawned a new generation of people who want to spend, spend, spend.
Nowadays, I would be very grateful that I have the luxury of thinking about a trip abroad, taking some courses after work to improve myself. And unfortunately, yes, I am a shopaholic.
Kai sent us that bit from an interview he did this week in China, and he's got a lot more on his blog at marketplace.org. Investors here did not appreciate that employment report one bit, closing out an ugly week on the Dow. We'll have details when we do the numbers. If you've been listening to our show at all this week, you know that the economic takeaway has been, well, kind of a bummer. Lousy economic indicators from manufacturing to unemployment, that's put all the U.S. recovery in doubt. And it all comes down as the powers that be in Washington continue to arm wrestle over the debt ceiling and spending cuts. Here for the weekly wrap on Wall Street and Beyond is Cardiff Garcia of the FT's Alphaville blog and Sudeep Reddy of the Wall Street Journal. Welcome back, gentlemen.
Hey, Tess.
So it was suggested in our newsroom this week that we avoid the use of a certain phrase that has popped back into the headlines. Let's see, it's a phrase meant to invoke the idea of a downturn followed by a short recovery and then another downturn. Get what I'm at here? Yeah? So without using that phrase, can you give us a sense of what's going on right now, Sudeep?
Well, this is being referred to in some cases as summer sluggishness, but it's a terrifying way to start the summer. We not only have all these problems in the U.S., but utter discord abroad with Europe and Greece melting down. And when you put all these factors together, you start to see a picture that you can't just write off as a rough patch or a soft disruption. It's more of a pothole that we're running into, and we keep running into it. It's the same situation we had a year ago, and that's got to worry a lot of people.
Yeah, Cardiff, we've actually been using it. It has two D's in front of it. Can we afford?
I won't say it.
Okay, thank you very much. Can we afford to have this kind of recovery roller coaster?
It's a little too early to say, but you know, one of the problems, as Sudeep just alluded to, is that earlier in the year, a lot of economists wanted to attribute the slowdown to temporary factors, whether it was the Japan earthquake or the Middle East, rising commodity prices, things like that. And it may just be that the economy was worse off than we thought all along, but. We had better hope not, because I think given the political environment right now, it's really unlikely that we're going to see any help coming from either the fiscal or the monetary policy side.
Well, let's talk about that, Sudeep. But the president, House Speaker John Boehner, the Treasury Department's Tim Geithner, they are all arguing over raising the debt ceiling and accompanying it with spending cuts. What is the argument now that the economy seems to be stalled to push for more cuts at this time?
The argument to push for more cuts is that there's so much of a problem with confidence that people are actually worried about the debt ceiling and the deficit that they want strong and decisive action now to get this problem off the table. And if you talk to a lot of business executives, they actually are thinking about this to some extent. But the problem is you don't want to do cuts that are so severe that you actually dig a deeper hole for us right now. And that's the risk that we're at. What we really need are cuts that will take effect in a couple years that are decisive and significant and deal with the risk of the deficit right now, and that'll satisfy Moody's and S&P and the ratings agencies, but really get past this moment that we're in.
Well, Cardiff, what about the counterargument? Is it possible to say that we shouldn't have any cuts at all?
Well, I just think Sudeep's absolutely right about this. The deficit's a problem, but this is a medium-term problem, not an immediate problem. And if you look at what bond markets are saying, they're not worried about it at all. So right now, I actually think that, the confidence argument is kind of a bogus one. There's very little evidence to actually support it. So I'm afraid I just don't see it.
Well, really quick, on a completely different topic, Groupon filed for an IPO this week. Can you give us some sense of what that says about the perhaps the tech sector versus the rest of the economy, Cardiff?
Yeah, well, I mean, everybody's a little bit worried that we're headed towards a tech bubble now. I think it's very possible we are. We probably are. But it's nothing like what we saw at the end of the 90s. And the fact that everybody's talking about a bubble probably means that there's a kind of a natural pause on that sort of thing. But at the same time, a company like Groupon, it's still not profitable. It's looking at the possibility of IPOing at a pretty outrageous valuation. So, yeah, I think investors should be very skeptical.
Sudeep?
And you have to be a little concerned, Tess, when you see people rushing into opportunities like this, whether it's LinkedIn or Groupon. It's in part because they don't see very many investment opportunities elsewhere, so they're really trying to pile on to this one area, and maybe that's a leading indicator of the troubles in the rest of the economy and the stock market.
All right. Sudeep Reddy and Cardiff Garcia joining us live from our bureaus in Washington and New York. Happy weekend, guys.
Thanks, you too.
Thanks, Tess.
Noticed quite a few companies rolling out new packaging lately. 7-Up has gone all retro. Bob Evans has updated its grocery store packaging. The sausage maker calls it a relaxed look, whatever that means. Even Jack Daniel's unveiled a new label. Makers of consumer products spend nearly $30 billion a year to figure out what sells, what doesn't, and why. And increasingly, they're using a technology first developed to help train British fighter pilots. It's called eye tracking. And we sent reporter Christopher Worth to have a look.
First, I want to find out what eye tracking is. So I've come to this supermarket in West London to meet Ian James from a company called iTracker. It's one of a growing number of agencies studying what consumers actually look at when they see ads or packaging on store shelves. James hands me a pair of glasses straight out of a sci-fi movie.
If you can pop those on.
Mounted on top are two small cameras.
One is we call it a field of vision camera, which collects everything that's in front of you.
And the other camera is pointed at my pupil and follows it wherever I look. When that's laid over the video of what I actually see, you get a set of crosshairs tracking every detail I focus on in the store.
And if you go off and do your shopping and come back and we'll have a look at the tape.
Okay. Now, if I can just find what I'm looking for. Sorry to bother you. Could you point me to the laundry detergent aisle? The clerk leads me to a long row with at least a dozen brands to choose from. Liquid detergent, powdered detergent. But my eyes quickly settle on a big blue box with a red logo and an image of a father and son playing in the grass. A detergent called Persil. I pick it up. And it costs £6.40. I bring the glasses back to Jane's, and we look at the tape of my purchase.
Okay, so you're now going to the detergent aisle. You're trying to decide which one to go for.
I like to think of myself as a price-conscious shopper, but when we watch the tape, I realize I hardly look at price tags at all. Jane says most shoppers are surprised to learn this about themselves.
The amount of time people actually spend looking at price is very, very small.
Instead, my crosshairs zero in on things like bright colors and logos with easy-to-read lettering.
Some of the best packaging we've ever researched has actually been incredibly simple.
Jane says my little test shows why eye tracking is so useful. Instead of relying on what people in focus groups say they look at, marketers can see for themselves what packaging catches a shopper's eye. And eye tracking can also help marketers figure out why we connect with certain products.
Generally, we shop in a subconscious mode.
I played my video for Nick Widdowson, who works with eye tracking at Unilever. It's the company that makes that box of Persil laundry detergent. Remember that picture of the father and son on the front? Widdowson notices I can't take my eyes off it.
From the amount of time you were looking at it, suggests that image seems to have struck a chord with you as a shopper.
Nick Williams is an expert on eye tracking at the market research firm Ipsos Mori. He says the image might be tapping into some kind of deep fatherly instinct.
Your paternal or otherwise thoughts won't be the key driver in what you're doing, but it's going to be relevant to how you shop.
And when I think about it, he's probably right. I am getting married soon, and my fiancé and I are thinking about starting a family. Who knew shopping could be so revealing?
In London, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
And there's a cool eye-tracking video from Christopher at marketplace.org. Coming up, picture the world in 2030.
There was a new disease that came up called virtual dementia, which is people literally not being able to tell what is real or virtual.
A look at the future with comedian Albert Brooks. But first, let's do the numbers. That grim jobs report capped a rough week on Wall Street. Today, the Dow slid 97 points, 0.8% to close at 12,151. The Nasdaq slumped 40 points, 1.5% to finish at 2732. And the S&P 500 dropped 12 points, 1% to end the day at 1300. It was the fifth straight week of losses. Over the past 4 days, all three indices each declined more than 2%. The market paired losses after a sharp morning sell-off at a factory in Ohio. President Obama cited the auto industry as an area of recent job growth. Still, General Motors shares fell 1.6 today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note again fell below the 3% threshold to 2.99%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The National Coalition for Homeless Veterans convenes its annual conference in Washington. On June 6, 1934, the Securities and Exchange Commission was established, and actor Robert Englund turns 64. He's been in many films, some that may give you nightmares, especially on Elm Street. Whatever you do, don't fall asleep. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal. Right about now, Sony probably wishes it could morph into one of its games, namely Dragon's Lair, Time Warp. Go back, 6 months or so, to a time before the company and its PlayStation network were hacked. It happened again today, and if you've lost track of security breaches at the company, we can't blame you. The attacks now seem to number in the dozens. Marketplace's Steve Henn brings us this story about Sony's descent into the online abyss.
When did Sony become such a tool? Chris Lytles, a security expert at Veracode, and says these days it's hard to keep all the attacks on the company straight.
It's even got to the point that at least two of the breaches in the first 10 happened on the same day.
So why is this happening now? A lot of techies, like Lytle, trace it to Sony's reaction to a hack of the PlayStation 3 by a kid known as GeoHot, or George Hotz. Back in January, Hotz cracked open the PS3 and made it possible for folks to write and play homebrewed video games, or copy games. Sony sued and was kind of nasty about it. This angered a lot of technically savvy people, and this spring, some of these folks began to strike back.
They were talking with Sony. They kept saying, hey, Sony, we know what's going on. We're reverse engineering your stuff. We're outsmarting your engineers. Do you want to hire us so we can work on this stuff with you? And Sony ignored them until kind of the point of no return.
Now, Microsoft faced some of these same issues when it released the Kinect. That motion-sensitive toy was catnip for thousands of geeks who wasted no time taking it apart. At first, Microsoft said no. But Mike Gartenberg, a tech analyst at Gartner, says some of the hacks were so cool, Microsoft changed its mind.
Basically said, hack away. And people have done all sorts of, you know, interesting, remarkable things. And that's a great way of getting enthusiasts on board with your product.
Sony may have had more to lose, but you've got to wonder if executives there would now love a do-over. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Let's play a game. Based on what's going on today in the U.S. economy, what do you think the country will look like in 20 years? How much more will the national debt rise? Where will we be in the global economic hierarchy compared to China? What if people started to live until they're 120 years old and there is no money to support them? And how about these developments? Ford and GM merge. Steroids are smokable. GPS is embedded in everything. And A 9.1 earthquake levels Los Angeles. Comedian Albert Brooks has written a novel, his first, where he imagines all that and more. The book is called 2030, The Real Story of What Happens to America. Albert Brooks, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So given the debate on Capitol Hill right now, I cannot wait for someone to get up on the House floor and cite what happens in your book as proof that we need to cut the deficit.
Yeah. Well, that would be great. I would love to see the cover held up, but... you know, I'm not sure they're reading anything over there right now, so I don't know that they're reading this book.
Well, in the book, by 2025, $3 trillion is going just to pay the interest on the national debt. Yeah. And what that means is that basically government can't do anything. No new programs. They're barely paying for things like Social Security and Medicare. Are you sure this is fiction?
I like fiction that can come true. It's just my preference. Normally, when you write about the future, you know, they call this dystopian, which I don't think it is, because the future is not going to be all good or all bad. Even in a disaster, there's good that comes out of it. And even in a beautiful wedding, three people are sick throwing up in the hall. So, you know, so I tried to present a future that has both.
So government is not only dealing with this debt, but cancer has been cured.
Yes.
Which sounds like a godsend. Who doesn't want that, right? But the knock-on effect is that people are living longer and longer, and they're sapping resources.
Yes.
So much so that the younger generation is near full rebellion. And
right. I have what's these gangs. They're
resentment
not
resentment gangs.
Yeah, they're called resentment gangs.
Yeah.
And they're not violent. They just hang out together, and they're angry. It's a main element of the story, and that's generational, almost warfare. I am part of the baby boom generation, and you know, I have young children, and I have seen in my lifetime this country go through a profound change where in the 50s and the 60s, and it was get, and grow, and it's not there anymore. And, you know, we're like the roadrunner. We've run off the cliff. And now this generation is looking down and not happy about that fall. And this becomes a problem.
How much of this fictional book is just pure entertainment? I was thoroughly entertained. But how much is also your concern over what's happening in the country? I mean, how much of this is you saying, hey, look, here's how bad it could actually get?
I'm concerned. I can't lie. I'd be an idiot not to be concerned. You know, I have eyes and ears, and I see what's going on, and I'm concerned. You know, when I was a child, there were no other countries that were competitors. All the other countries in the world sort of made our radios and our toys, and you know, that's all they were to us. And that's changed. As China and India move up, we're not moving up in proportion to them. We're coming down. And it's more fun to move up than to move down.
This is so bleak.
No, it actually isn't. Well, you know, there's a lot of humor in the book.
Yes.
They cured Alzheimer's.
Right.
They cured cancer. And they got a major hook into schizophrenia, but there was a new disease that came up called virtual dementia.
Virtual dementia.
Which is people literally not being able to tell what is real or virtual. And real people scare them and they don't act right around them.
That's purely L.A., isn't it?
What, virtual dementia?
Yeah, fake people?
Well, no. L.A. has real fake people. These are fake people.
Albert Brooks is the author of 2030, The Real Story of What Happens to America. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for
pleasure.
Coming.
Thank you, Tess.
If you'd like a taste of what life might be like in 2030, at least according to Mr. Brooks, you can find the first chapter of the book on our book blog at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And this final note today, TGIF style, a look back at the news of the week with stories that did not quite make the headlines, courtesy of Rico Galliano, Brendan Francis Newnham, and select members of the Marketplace staff.
John Haas, editor, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
All the tech blogs are talking about a prototype alarm clock that would have a built-in shredder, and you place money into the alarm clock, and if you hit the snooze and don't get up in time, it shreds your dollar bills.
But this is not for sale yet, you're saying?
No, but the mock-up photos that are online simulating a $100 bill being shredded.
Gets the point across.
Definitely. No, fortunately, it does not exist. I would lose so much money.
I would lose a lot of sleep. I don't think I would ever fall asleep out of fear.
Avishai Artsy, assistant producer for Marketplace. What's your story?
A woman in Pennsylvania goes to take money out of an ATM and her hand gets sucked in.
Wait, this really happened?
Yeah, it took firefighters to get her out.
All right, so who's going to say it, you or me?
Yeah, it costs an arm and a leg.
I was thinking that this identity verification thing has gone too far.
George Judson, managing editor, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, there's a company up in San Francisco called Hipster.com. They're hiring, and they're offering a $10,000 hiring bonus.
All right.
A year's worth of Pabst Blue Ribbon, oversized glasses, skinny jeans, a bow tie, mustache grooming.
All the accoutrements of being a hipster, is what you're saying.
Yes, exactly.
Public radio should do this. They could give you like a, you know...
Prius.
Or a Volvo.
Birkenstocks. I actually have Birkenstocks, so it's not just a stereotype.
Wine club.
Cheap wine club.
Yeah, and a year's supply of tote bags. That's not negotiable.
You can hear more of what Brendan and Rico have to offer on their podcast, The Dinner Party Download. We've got a link at marketplace.org. Oh, beware of those ATMs. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow slid 97 points, 0.8%. The Nasdaq slumped 40 points, 1.5%. And the S&P 500 dropped 12 points. That is 1%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is JJ Yore. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, talking to your aging parents about their finances is a tough but necessary conversation.
It's a delicate balancing act. You don't want to make them feel that you don't trust in their abilities or don't respect what they've achieved.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Enjoy your weekend. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.